Welcome to Simpler One Earth Living from Simple Living Works and Jubilee One Earth Economics. This is Simple Living Works podcast episode 110 with my guest, educator and author, Mark A. Birch. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Mark Birch is an author, educator, and group facilitator who has practiced simple living since the 1960s, and since 1995 has offered presentations, workshops, and courses on voluntary simplicity. He is the retired director of the Campus Sustainability Office for the University of Winnipeg, former co-director of the Simplicity Practice and Resource Center, and former instructional fellow with the Canadian School of Peacebuilding in Winnipeg, Manitoba. He has been a featured guest on Canadian Broadcast Corporation Radio and Television. He has published 5 books on voluntary simplicity, including The Hidden Door, Mindful Sufficiency as an Alternative to Extinction, and Stepping Lightly, Simplicity for People and the Planet. In 2012, he wrote 8 papers for the Simplicity Institute in Australia. He also wrote the handy Simplicity Study Circles, a step-by-step guide. Most recently, he has moved to futuristic fiction with Utera Rising, The Last Utopia. Here's Mark Birch, recently recorded. I became acquainted with Mark Birch through his book, Stepping Lightly, Simplicity for People and the Planet. And it's available now in paperback as well as a Kindle edition. And that came out in 2011. And since then, he's been involved in a number of really fascinating things. Mark is from Canada, but he's also done quite a bit of work with a group called the Simplicity Institute in New Zealand. So he brings a really welcome international flavor to this podcast. So, Mark, can you, we'll talk more about your more recent books a little later, but can you tell about the motivation and the impetus behind writing Simply Lightly and then moving on to the 8 papers that you wrote for the Simplicity Institute and a little bit about the Simplicity Institute itself?
What motivated me to write Stepping Lightly was developing a course, a university level course for the University of Winnipeg back in 1998. And I'd read widely in the simplicity literature, but I wasn't finding a particular source that I could use as a textbook. I was making up a fairly hefty course pack of readings selected from different sources, which I continued to do. But there was definitely a need for some sort of overview of the whole interest area of simple living. And so I decided to write a book for that. My involvement with the Simplicity Institute, it's headquartered in Melbourne, Australia, actually, started some years ago when Samuel Alexander, who's the executive director of the Institute, got a hold of me and said, we're creating this Institute to try to build a more sophisticated, philosophically sophisticated foundation for simplicity as an alternate way of life here. And we'd like to publish a chapter from one of your books, from a book I published in 1995 with New Society Publishers called Simplicity, Notes, Stories, and Exercises for Developing Unimaginable Wealth, which was sort of cheeky, but also descriptive. So, that started my relationship with them, and the Simplicity Institute is a virtual entity. It consists of probably a dozen faculty members or fellows, such as myself, and we contribute periodically. Sometimes Sam Alexander says, you know, I'd like to develop a theme around steady-state economics or around environmental resilience or sustainability. And do you have ideas or have you written stuff related to that? So every once in a while, he'll put out a call, and those of us who can and wish and have time to contribute do. And they've been kind to me in terms of publishing a number of my essays and two of my books. So that's basically the relationship. Their mission in the world is to develop a serious intellectual basis for simple living and really extend it beyond the bounds of simply being a lifestyle choice, a personal lifestyle choice, and begin to look at things that are of about social policies through a lens of a low consumption society. So what would education look like, or technology, or the process of energy descent that we're going through, which has already started from fossil fuels and so on. So that's their main mission. And I'm just amazed at some of the contributions that have been made to that. It's really solid stuff, but it's not always. Well, The Simpler Way is one of their publications and one of their research areas, and that really is focused on individual lifestyle choices and strategies for living more simply. But a lot of the other stuff is more macro in perspective.
Now, it seems to me that they are living what they preach. I hear and read some of their projects that do involve, you know, structures and farming and things like that.
That's right. I mean, they have set up an experimental eco-village called Wuru Khan, which is, I think, about 80 kilometers out of Melbourne in a rural area in Australia. And they've been at that project now for probably about 2 years. So it's, I haven't been there, so I can't make a firsthand description of it or testimony about what it does. But the pictures and the feedback and the articles and things which have come out of it that I have read suggest to me that it's kind of a demonstration site rather than a really permanent community. And they've done things like building cob houses and using solar energy in various applications and, you know, trying things out to demonstrate their feasibility or their doability in that part of the world. So, and Sam himself and other members of the faculty, including myself, are invited from time to time to address conferences and meetings related to sustainable or unsustainable consumption and ecological resilience and so on.
Well, thanks for that introduction to the Simplicity Institute, and I'll be sure to include a link in the show notes to this podcast. Now, I understand that you've been director of the Campus Sustainability Office for the University of Winnipeg and also co-director of the Simplicity Practice and Resource Center and former instructional fellow with the Canadian School of Peacebuilding in Winnipeg. Also appeared on a number of TV and radio programs, particularly with the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So was it through some of those places that you were teaching some of these courses?
Yeah, it was. pardon me, I started my relationship with the University of Winnipeg in 1998. And I developed a sort of pilot version of my voluntary Simplicity course, which was then 8 weeks long. And it was actually being delivered through the Faculty of Theology, because they had a graduate level theology program where people training for the ministry were sort of taking additional academic upgrading courses or special interest courses. So they invited me to, they had read my book, one of my first books, and then invited me to come and create this 8-week course initially as this sort of professional upgrading course for ministry. And there was quite a bit of interest in it, and the enrollment grew. So the university moved the course into its International Development Studies program, which is largely staffed and was developed from the Mennonite community here in Canada, because they have a strong international justice and development focus and peace focus. And it seemed that voluntary simplicity fit in that context. And I tried to make sure it did. But by 2000, we had increased the course to 13 weeks, which made it a university semester course and made it much more academically rigorous and enriched the readings and the rest of the stuff that was support for the course. And I wound up teaching it 19 times over the next 6 years. And it was extremely popular. I mean, the class was always full and there was always a waiting list of young people interested in exploring this idea and this way of life. So in 2005, I was asked by the president of the University of Winnipeg if I could lead a campus sustainability initiative, because while they did piecemeal things, like they had a bit of a recycling program going on, and they had people struggling in various corners to make changes in the university, there wasn't a comprehensive, coherent, policy-based system in place, even to systematically and thoroughly collect information on how the university was performing. So I created a campus sustainability council with people from all different faculties and students. Then I set up a number of working groups, 8 or 9 of them, as I remember, that were based on the International Standards Organization Environmental Management Standard 14,000 something. So we used that ISO standard as a template for how to create systems in the university that could actually measure water instead of money, and kilowatts instead of money, and tons of material waste instead of just garbage fees. So most major institutions look at dollars, and that's what's of interest to them. And a large part of my work was to convince people that dollars and kilowatts are, dollars don't matter to the planet, kilowatts do. And so we need to start measuring all of these things. And when we did, I mean, after a year or two of that, we began to have a basis in evidence for proposing and prioritizing interventions that could actually measurably reduce the university's ecological footprint. So by the time I left, I was in that position for 5 years and then retired from it. By the time I left, the university's greenhouse gas footprint was 30% below the Kyoto target of 6% below 1990. So they had just, I mean, the university had achieved miracles. Everywhere else in Canada, there's been about a 30% increase in GHG emissions over the last 20 years, most of it attributable to economic growth. And so we basically zeroed out the effects of that economic growth, plus we took it 30% lower at a time when the university enrollment had grown by about 25%. So it was a huge achievement, and partly due to the work that my teams did early on, but also due to a commitment by the university to continue that work after my departure and after the systems were built. I mean, people need to keep on keeping on, right, to see these things happening. So my involvement with the Canadian Peacebuilding Institute, that is an outgrowth of another university in the same city here, the Canadian Mennonite University. And it's a summer intensive program that draws together people with interests in peacebuilding and also in international development. And on one occasion, I taught another version of my same course for them. That was in the summer of 2011, I think. So those are those things, how they're related and so on.
Well, those are remarkable stories, Mark. Thank you for sharing them. I only hope that others will follow your example. It's interesting, too, that I don't find in your books a particularly religious bent. I mean, you don't promote the Mennonite religion or Catholicism or Buddhism or Islam, but you do talk about spirituality.
That's
and
right.
So is that, am I perceiving that correctly?
Yeah. When I taught the Simplicity course, I did have a unit on spiritual simplicity. And at the time, I was a practicing Catholic. Now I'm a Quaker. But what I tried to do, well, my assumption was that there's a universal spiritual dimension in human experience. This is part of being human, is discovering and relating to this spiritual dimension of our life. Different religious traditions code that differently. They use different symbols and different language, but the realities that it points to are universal. So for purposes of the course, I mean, recognizing the diversity of students and backgrounds and belief systems that you have, even in a classroom of just 30 or 40 people, I wanted to adopt a language and an angle on spirituality which would be universally acceptable, or something that people at least felt a comfort level with, even if they came from a place of very clear identity with a particular tradition. I always used to befuddle my students because I said, well, deep down, I'm a Judeo-Buddha-Christian, which I guess to some ears would say, well, this guy can't make up his mind about where his commitments lie. But on the other hand, I think it's descriptive of my sensibility that each tradition has wonderful things to offer. So I wanted to create a space where we could talk about our spirituality and how we grow closer, develop a relationship with things that are greater than personal, older than us and wiser than us, and how we do that and how that comes from each tradition and the role that simplicity has played in that, largely through monastic asceticism and other kinds of things. So that was the approach I took, and that was the reason for it, was just to have a conversation about what I think is a very important department of human life, at the same time that we adopted a language and an approach that was inclusive and could make everybody feel welcome and able to participate.
Let's move on to your next book, Mark, The Hidden Door, Mindful Sufficiency as an Alternative to Extinction.
The Hidden Door was published in 2013, and that was in partnership with the Simplicity Institute in Australia. And it has really been the last book that I've written, and probably the last book that I will write, which is nonfiction, and the focus of which is voluntary simplicity. And because I've sort of come to this realization in my life, I wish I had a lot sooner, that reasoned arguments don't seem to appeal to people or hook up with people as readily as stories do. So I started writing fiction, and I'm really enjoying the writing process. And I'm discovering that people relate to it and get excited about it much more readily than a nonfiction or expository essay approach. Anyway, Hidden Door was intended to be a contribution to opening up the conversation around simplicity that moved it away from an individual lifestyle choice. Well, not away from, but added to the individual lifestyle choice part of simple living, that it might be used as a lens, that we could take mindfulness and sufficiency, combine those into a sort of worldview, and then use that as a lens to look at social institutions and say, how might the simplicity movement become a politics of simplicity, or a public policy development process around simplicity, if we had a consensus in society that a lower consumption lifestyle was a desirable thing, then what would education look like? What would communications look like? What would the economy look like? And so on. So I introduce in a very condensed way the meanings associated with simple living. Then I look at mindfulness as a practice, and for me, it's totally the foundation practice for simple living is the cultivation of mindfulness, or in a more Christian framework, like a contemplative approach to living. where we're constantly attentive to the spiritual overtones and ecological undertones of our lifestyle choices. So cultivating that deliberately through a mindfulness practice, I think, is foundational. And then what characterizes voluntary simplicity is a conscious and recurring commitment to sufficiency rather than pursuing affluence. So constantly asking, how much is enough? Is this something I need? Or if it's not something I need, is it a permissible luxury, like one that doesn't impose conditions of oppression on anyone else or any other beings, whether they're human or not? So if we take that lens and then we apply it to these different areas of social concern, can we break up the soil here and start to have a conversation about a politics that might bring these things into the sphere of public policy? So that was the purpose behind writing the book, was basically to move from the micro scale of the individual to the macro scale of social policy and try to make the message of simplicity relevant in that larger than individual conversation.
Excellent. Well, Mark, let's move on, since you've already broached the topic, to your first novel, Utera Rising, The Last Utopia. Now, this book is not typical science fiction dysfunctionality future. This is an engaging book set in the 23rd century, but there's interesting forces that are still working it's not a dystopia, but there's still tension between people who have moved on and people who want to hold back to the old consumer ways, the brotherhood. Tell us about
that. That's right.
Yeah. Utera, just for people, Utera is Greek, it means good earth.
That's right. Happy earth, yes. I have a friend here with whom I often have coffee and have very lively discussions about all kinds of things. He's a retired sociology prof from another of the universities in town. And we were having coffee one day, and he said, "Did you ever read any utopian literature when you were younger?" And I said, "Oh, sure, you know, Aldous Huxley's Island and B.F. Skinner's Walden 2. And we started reeling off titles to each other of these things we had read. And he said, "Have you seen any of this stuff lately?" And, you know, I sort of thought about that question, and I thought, well, you know, it's been 20 or 30 years, really, since anyone has written anything other than dystopian fiction. These awful scenarios of, you know, where we're headed. And I thought, well, you know, that's really significant, because it's kind of, it evokes an archetype, a collective archetype that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if people see no positive alternative futures for themselves. And I said, no, I don't know of any. And he didn't know of any. And the two of us being extremely erudite, we thought, well, you know, maybe I should write something. So he says, well, why don't you write one? And it got into me sort of as this kind of earworm of why don't I write it? And it struck a resonance in my imagination that maybe I could attempt such a thing. And so I started to think about it, and it literally took me 3 or 4 months to try to shake off the negative imagery and feeling tone that surrounds so much sort of future-oriented fiction these days, until I could come to a positive place and say, well, you know, what might a society look like that had spiritual practice at its center and voluntary simplicity as a social norm, and had developed these things to a high level of sophistication, and also lived in a world which is a real world, like a world where consumer culture has passed away, as it is about to do or is in the process of doing right now. It's over. It's going soon to be gone. But That will imply some difficulty ahead and some shadowy territory we have to pass through. But eventually, I imagine that human beings survived. Some of us did. And we learned the lessons of what we've been through here for the last three centuries and how misguided it's been in many ways. And they decide to create something new. But they are also living in the context of the long-term consequences through climate change, through loss of collective memory, through an energy descent, through a technological descent. All of these things are implied in a future beyond consumerism, and they're circumstances that the Uterans have to deal with somehow. So they have a fairly clear image of who they want to be as a society, but they're living in a world with constrained choices. And you're right, there's also a remnant of a group that, a smaller group, that continues to stoke the expectations and the dreams and the delusions that they can grow continuously and they can return to the glory days of consumerism. So those two societies are in conflict, and that conflict partly drives the book. But a lot of it is, it's not at all science fiction. And there isn't a classification for what I've written. And there's some other works of literature as well that don't fit these classifications. I think the best one was suggested by another Canadian writer named Margaret Atwood, who said her novels are speculative fiction. And I think that's where I would put Uterra Rising as well. It's a work of speculative fiction or utopian fiction.
I noticed that in addition to the book, you also have a blog called Dispatches from Uterra.
The idea behind that was, what might I add to my website that allows for Uterans from three centuries in the future to write dispatches back to us at this historical moment, commenting on conditions which exist now? So if we have, say, a particular person in the White House, how would that be viewed three centuries from now, looking back from a Uteran perspective? And if they could send us a letter saying, oh, well, we noticed that in history, and parts of it we don't understand, and parts of it got lost, but this is what we think, what would that blog be like? And so I place myself in the persona of one or another of my characters from Uterra Rising. They introduce themselves at the beginning of the blog entry, and then they launch off on a commentary about one or another aspect of the world of 2018. So that was the idea. But the dispatches are hard to write. So it's been fun doing them, but they're difficult.
Well, that's really fascinating, Mark. Now, it seems to me like you are trying to appeal to young adults, to a younger generation, and that's admirable. I see developing, especially in the United States, a movement called minimalism. We have the minimalists.
Right.
We have other organizations be called Becoming Minimalist. And so am I correct about that? And do you find that movement at all growing in Canada? Here in the U.S., there are chapters sprouting various places as the minimalists travel about and produce documentaries and books and courses.
I'm aware of the movement. I did watch one movie about it, somewhere on Netflix, I think. I have met a couple of people who claim to be minimalists. I don't know how much impact it will have, and I'm a little uneasy with it. Because I guess the way I've portrayed voluntary simplicity is always as a means to an end, not as an end in itself. And I think minimalism runs the risk of doing that, of just making our lives as material-free as possible, which from an ecological perspective, I guess, is desirable. But from a human potential perspective, it's not as attractive to me. So I, when I was teaching the course on simplicity, I'd always begin with my students to say, you know, let's explore what's of value to you. Because voluntary simplicity was originally defined by Richard Gregg, who introduced the idea as the deliberate organization of life for a purpose. And I see minimalists sort of taking off to deliberately organize their lives, but not necessarily clear on why. So I urge people to identify the purpose for which you live, and then allow that to bring structure into your material existence. The other thing that I am uncomfortable with in the minimalist movement is that it basically does the same thing as exporting your ecological footprint. You know, maybe you can't do anything in your kitchen besides boil water, but you're going to eat somewhere. So probably you'll go to restaurants and you'll be sitting in a restaurant eating a meal, congratulating yourself on how minimalist you are and how you don't really have all this cooking gear in your own house. But you still go to a place where the conditions of production might be very questionable, where people might be exploited in terms of setting the table for you and serving you, and where the ecological consciousness of the restaurant might be minimal. And the same goes with cars. You know, I know people who are proud to say they don't own a car, but they readily accept rides from everyone else. So is it, you know, helpful merely to pursue minimalism for its own sake without necessarily keeping in view the purpose for doing that, that gives form, structure, and harmony and beauty to a life which is based on purpose and has become efficient in pursuing that purpose? So, yeah, it would be an interesting conversation to have. And I sort of have the same feelings around the tiny house movement. That's hugely popular in the United States and it's picking up here. And I think it's, you know, partly a response to just the craziness of the real estate market, that it's very, very hard for young people to save down payments and to actually get into single family homes. And this is an adaptive measure, you know, going for a tiny house that costs $20,000 instead of a house that costs $500,000. But, life in a tiny house also implies quite a bit of exporting one's footprint and also very limited options in terms of producing for own consumption. Hard to have a garden, hard to raise your own food, not much room for the cherry tree in the front yard. So these things matter in terms of simplicity, and going too far in the minimalist direction, I think, compromises your options.
Very insightful, Mark. Thank you so much. And I will, of course, include in the show notes your website, markabirch, no spaces, no punctuation, .ca. Not .com, not .org, but .ca as in Canada.
That's right.
I would like to just know if you have some other plans for the near or far future for your writing or for your other endeavors.
Charlotte and I, my wife and I, live on a property in the city of Winnipeg, and our lot is 50 by 120 feet or something, 6,000 square feet, and our house takes up about 750 of that. The rest of it has all been converted to gardens. So we produce as much food, flowers, herbs, and other things on the property as we can fit in. Certainly with spring coming, we'll be looking at that and giving that some time. In terms of my writing, I've written a prequel to Utera Rising called Utera Genesis, The Ruination. And it is in production now, should be out probably the end of March, middle of April. So when I finished writing Euterra Rising, I sort of had the feeling that it was actually the middle book of a trilogy. And so I started writing the prequel, which is done now. And I'll be turning my attention to one or more sequels. And people have asked, are you aiming to write a trilogy? And I've said, no, not really. I'm aiming to write a cycle of stories that use Euterran culture as the main focus or setting repeatedly. So Euterra Genesis is on the way. There's another book I'm working on called the Euterran Chronicles, which looks at the 300-year space of history between Euterra Genesis and Euterra Rising. And I have ideas for a lot of stories and things to fit into that space to basically fill in the history of the Euterran city-state as we find it in Euterra Rising. So I've also written, well, sort of continue to write, it's an ongoing project, a Euterran encyclopedia, which is about Euterran culture and history. So it's the background that I use for writing the other stories. And when new ideas occur to me, then I add them to the encyclopedia, or I write a short story about them and put them in the chronicles. So I kind of see that as an ongoing project for as long as I can do it. And of course, I'm involved in my community and my neighborhood with my faith group. I'm going to be offering a short course for friends in my Quaker meeting starting next month on voluntary simplicity from the angle of friends' traditional testimonies. I'm also a co-editor of learning series for Canadian friends. We publish these pamphlets, which are usually essays or oral presentation summaries of about 10,000 words, as spiritual enrichment resources for friends and any who wish to find them across Canada. And I have 5 grandchildren, so, you know, things happen. Well, I wanted to say I stand in awe of your commitment and the contribution that you've made to simple living and living that's faith-based and actively informed by your faith commitment. I'm really grateful for the work that you've done over the years and honored to be interviewed by you and that you would keep a note about my books as they appear.
You've been listening to my conversation with author and educator Mark Birch. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Simple Living Works Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. Subscribe to Jubilee One Earth newsletter before Easter and receive a free copy of the new book, Jubilee Circles. I urge you to subscribe to one of Simple Living Works' free publications. Our blog is called Simpler Living Weekly Nudge. Just send the word blog to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. Subscribe for free to today's Simpler Living Nudge to receive a short, thought-provoking item every day by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. In 2018, Simple Living Works Weekly Digest has been discontinued and the Simple Living Works podcast reduced to 1 episode per month, issued on the 15th. The complete Simple Living Works Monthly Digest on the Simple Living Works site will continue to feature the latest posts from colleague organizations and will be updated weekly. Simpler Living Weekly Nudge will feature offerings from Simple Living Works. It comes as your free subscription to the Simple Living Works blog. choose the options that work for you. Subscribers to Simple Living Works podcast will receive the Common Good podcast, which I produce and co-host, on the first of the month. Likewise, subscribers to the Common Good podcast will receive Simple Living Works podcast on the 15th as a bonus. So, Simple Living Works podcast subscribers will continue to receive two episodes per month. This makes good sense, since the missions of both Simple Living Works and Jubilee One Earth Economics are so complementary, and the two work together closely. This combined project we now call Simpler One Earth Living. Your comments on these changes are welcome. I'm lining up inspiring thinkers and activists for this year. Soon, Susan Taylor of Just Money Advisors about her book, What About Our Money? Since I converse with many writers, you may want to read some of their books. I have strong opinions and hopefully helpful suggestions about where to get books. I hope you'll read my short article. The link is in the show notes. Well, time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast or like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember, you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast, our weekly blog, and daily nudges are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news rather than the weekly blog. The e-news is now the mid-month edition of the blog. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the show music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All of our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. As you may sense, we put a strong emphasis on social justice. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 through 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We hope our half-hour podcasts are educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simpler One Earth Living Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.